government as evil, intelligence as particularly evil. And I think Amish Mag kind of looked at it in a sense that we will jeopardize our position here if it becomes known that our officers are sharing information with the embassy or CIA or anybody else. I thought that was too bad because the military establishment in any country is a fairly critical target for intelligence coverage, what is happening in the military, as in Libya, for example. But that's the way it is, and you know, that isn't the end of thing. It just makes it more difficult. If you're going from here to San Jose and 101 and 280 are out, you can get there via Oakland. But it takes a little longer, and it's a little more difficult. But that is basically an American position abroad, as opposed to the British. My God, if a British citizen sees a strange tree frog on a palm tree in Khartoum, the next time he gets near a British embassy, he'll go in and tell somebody. But that's the legacy of empire. We have such an ambivalent attitude toward intelligence, either information or let alone covert action.
What about the business community in Iran? How cooperative were they with the station?
We had almost nothing to do with that. I personally, I had some friends in the business community, but they were not people of intelligence interest to me. They, again, didn't know very much about Iran other than their very narrow perspective, whatever job they had or connections they had. And what they knew was not of terribly great interest to us because we needed information in much greater depth. We knew what their contracts were because, you know, they were importing and exporting goods and personnel and so on. And sometimes they had access to things of interest to us. And sometimes we'd say, by the way, you went off to Kerman, are they working the coal fields? But that's an embassy function, and that's not intelligence collection as such.
I see.
And some would say, sure, they're working the coal mines, but I didn't really notice. Or, I've got an engineer out there right now surveying possible new coal fields or whatever. But again, that's an embassy function, and that's pretty benign. It's not, you go out to the coal field, and I want to know how thick the seam is, and where it surfaces, and how they're digging, how much coal's coming out, where it's going, what the price is, etc. Because what's public knowledge, or in the public domain, is really for somebody else to collect. If you're going to use limited resources to collect intelligence, that which is not in the public domain.
I'm not sure if you can address this or not, but did they provide cover for CIA officers?
No, goodness sakes, not that I know of. Well, what if they did? I mean, if they did, I would say no, they didn't. And if they didn't, I would say no, they didn't. I mean, the answer has to be the same no matter what happened. But there was really no need for that, was there, at the time? As opposed to the time of the hostages. You should go talk to Russ Perot. The Eagle Has Landed, wasn't it? The book about the rescue of his
prisoner. Yeah, I haven't read that yet.
Interesting man. Yeah. I've never met him. I'd like to do that sometime. I'd like to sit down along then and talk with Ross about Iran. Because there was a man of great appetite and energy. Whether one agrees with his politics is a whole other subject.
How long did you continue working on Iran as such at Langley?
No, a few months.
Pardon me?
A few months.
Oh, after you came back in 71. It was only a matter of months that you were working on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you just went on to other things from there?
Yeah.
Okay. But you maintain your contacts with
of course.
Iranians?
Oh, yes. Had a lot of Iranian friends in Washington.
And you were saying?
There's a very large expatriate Iranian community at the time. Thousands of Iranian students came here, and I knew many of their parents. And when I went back, looked up many of the students just to touch in and say hello and call me if you need anything. And there were others in and out of the embassy and in and out of various Iranian missions that I knew, personal friends. So yes, I stayed in touch with them. There's a very large Iranian community here in the Bay Area. That many of them kind of expatriates, members of the Shah's government, and many of them tied in with the Mujahideen. I presume many of them tied in with the Mullahs. A great cross-section, there are thousands of Iranians in this area doing various things. And I know a number of them. Some I consider friends, some I consider just acquaintances. They're very skillful people. They're good business people. They're generally acute, intellectually acute, savvy. Very interesting cultural persistence again. They were successful in Iran and they'd be successful here. They tend to be the people who are successful, that is, the adventurous, the curious, with enough confidence to come to a strange country, pack it up. And some had to, but others chose to.
But after you did no further work on Iran during the rest of your years with...
I did some work on it now and again.
It was back in the operations branch.
I stayed with the operations branch until I retired in 86.
Did you do any work on Iran during the Carter years? Or?
Yes.
Anything you could talk about now, or in terms of how the CIA covered the deepening of the opposition in the 77, 78, and the outbreak of the revolution?
No, I was really out of touch with it by then. After the coup, of course, or after the overthrow of the Shah, there was a lot of work to do, a lot of people to meet, contacts to refurbish. It was hard to get intelligence, and we needed it very badly. We were concerned about the hostages. So I knew a lot of Iranians, and to a certain degree tried to contribute to that.
A resolution of the hostage crisis.
That was a tragedy, wasn't it? In many dimensions.
You're saying?
The hostage crisis and how it developed and the inability of Washington to even to listen to, by that time, the embassy, which was very concerned about the implications of our accepting the Shah and several other things that went with that. As I think, quote unquote, everybody knows, the embassy warned the U.S. government there's a problem. And here is one likely outcome, and of course, very few predictions come true, but that one certainly did. But again, you it goes back to ignoring the events of 63. You really have to understand at a certain level, you have to understand what's happening in the dynamics of it in order for information about that to make any sense. So that knowing there were so many cows in Schleswig-Holstein in a certain year is meaningful only in the sense that the rest of Europe was starving. But you have to know that, or else the number of cows doesn't mean anything. And you have to believe that the embassy understood what was happening and why, whatever other problems Sullivan had. We're carrying water in both shoulders, or all six shoulders, as a matter of fact, trying to figure out how to relate to this new government. But we didn't make it. We just didn't make it. We didn't add up one and one and get two. We got 1.3 or ABC or something else. The world does look very different from Washington than it does from a given country. And the ground truth is always difficult to lay up against the theory. I guess that's one of the problems I have with journalists. It's one of the problems I have with scholars, some of them. The other side of the coin is that both have the ability to discern things which you, the forest as opposed to the trees. Ideally, you marry both perspectives, but that doesn't often happen. And it certainly didn't happen in the case of Iran. But certainly the Yom Kippur War is an example of inertia, intellectual, mental inertia. Neither the Israelis nor the Americans saw it coming. And in some senses, one might say the Shah didn't see the revolution coming, and if he didn't, why the hell should anybody else? The fact of the matter is, if you added up one plus one after the fact, if you presently had access to every report written in Iran from 1960 to 1979, you would say, of course, it couldn't lead anywhere but to revolution. Or you might say, nope, I don't see it. Tea leaves don't show that. But it would have been an impressive political leader indeed to have been able to sell the U.S. government on the proposition the Shah was going to be overthrown in 1979, regardless of the information available.
Were you working on Iran during the course of 78 and 79? Not. Okay. I was wondering if you had any, how you read it at that time.
Some years before,
yeah, yeah.
After I came back from Kabul, I was on the Afghan desk, and one of the analysts came over, and we had lunch together. He said, you know, we have this kind of a funny message here. Did you see it? And I said, no. It was a cable from the ambassador. We had a long talk. King Zafir Shah.
Mm-hmm.
King Zafir Shah. He was the king of Afghanistan at the time. And the ambassador had been bending a great deal of effort to bringing about this interview, and he'd been there a couple of 3 years and never got one. He finally got one, and Zahir Shah was just as nice to him as you can imagine. He was a very charming man. Was graceful and complimentary of the work the ambassador had done, the American mission, and I read it with absolute perplexed response. I couldn't understand what was going on. And the analyst said, well, what do you think that is? Why do you think Zahir Shah did that? And I thought of all, I said, well, I think probably the Afghans made a deal with the Soviets, which we'll hear about shortly. Which, in fact, yes, it turned out to be that. And that's not all that hard to read. But the point was that this marvelous, warm, almost gushy message had come in and set everybody in Washington, and certainly the ambassador, in a state of euphoria, breakthrough, marvelous. So that when the deal was announced, all you did was come back to where you were before. Well, this is a problem we all have. We do hear what we want to hear, and we read it the way we want to read, because it fits comfort levels and proclivities, and it takes a particular type of honesty to a level of acceptable skepticism. I don't mean cynicism, I mean skepticism. It's Pinafore that said, things are seldom what they seem, skim milk masquerades as cream, and if you don't understand that in the Middle East, I don't think you understand anything. Why the Middle East? Why not here? Well, we just elected a mayor that many people feel is quite a different man from the one they elected. Goldwater was condemned for wanting to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age, and Johnson up the military ante. Jimmy Carter is going to be a friend of the people and change the government inside. Yeah, things don't work out that way. What kind of a president will George Bush be, historian? What kind of a president will Mike Dukakis be? Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, if the Shah didn't see it coming, yeah, maybe he did. But our propensity for deluding ourselves in favor of more comfortable analyses is legendary all over the world. The other side of it is that we tend to get very strident when we identify a real problem. And we tend to be unable to see it through, whatever the policy may be, and whatever country may be involved. How you get Congress to support with money, always scarce, resources, always scarce, the support to and sustaining of an American presence or fulfillment of American policy over time is a very difficult question. A very difficult question. If you're not going to send in proconsuls the way the British did, what are you going to do? And how are you going to keep political attention focused on a country like Iran? Again, remembering what the world's like, when there are many other things that require your attention. We don't seem able to do them.
Now, over the years, people have written and argued that in the years after the CIA helped set up Sabat in the late 50s, that agents at one time or the other provided instruction directly or indirectly in interrogation methods or possibly even in torture. Can you shed any light on that question?
The answer is that the agency did not. Occam's razor, okay? What in the name of heaven, who in the United States, let alone someone who presumably has enough intelligence to be hired by the agency, who in the United States could teach the Persians anything about torture? That is ludicrous. That is absolutely absurd. And it reflects much more on a person who would assert that than on any level of reality. Where would an American learn how to torture people? In New York City? In Washington? But where is the school for torture that would lead this man to know more of, to know enough about torture that he could go to a foreign country and teach somebody how to torture people? That is, that is so far out that, of course, as I say, I think it reflects on the person who would make such an assertion. One thing about the agency that perhaps is overlooked on occasion, the agency is not made up from a select group of people who are born and bred by some genetic formula and grown up in the Texas desert and trained in the obscure mountains of Colorado to produce persons who are different from other Americans. They go to liberal arts colleges, they are linguists, they are travelers, they have appetites and curiosity and children and interests and so on, albeit different from many. I don't know how many people, agency people, you've met in your life, but by and large, they're a pretty decent group of people. At least I have always found them to be. In my last year and a half in commercial America, I wouldn't trade one station full of people for the people I work with now, by any stretch of the imagination, in terms of acuity, interest, capabilities, intelligence, ethics. One forgets that people join the agency for reasonably selfless motives, as you certainly don't make money. Your kids are on intravenous feeding. My son was 3 weeks old when he was on intravenous feeding. He lived in a house full of scorpions. You have more diseases than people have listed. You spend a good deal of time being sick, and so does your family. You don't live terribly well, and it is very tough, and the hours are long, and the pay is lousy, and people do it therefore, not because they are some kind of Neanderthal politicians. As a matter of fact, most of the people that I was with in the agency, I would guess, are to the left of center in the American political spectrum. They are political activists, certainly, or they wouldn't be in the director of operations. They'd be writing books or mowing lawns. It's a very interesting group of people, and a far cry from anyone who would think of torturing people, or learning how to torture people, or teaching someone else to torture people. I think that is just a canard, and obviously so.
I think the charges from my recollection now were made by Jesse Lee.
Who?
Jesse Lee, who left the agency in 73. It was a New York Times article that, you know, when he was interviewed, he talked about this whole issue. But does he
I'm sorry, that name doesn't ring a bell. AG, of course, has been saying this for years.
Yeah.
But that's a different kettle of fish. He gets his pay from the Cubans and the Soviets. Whatever led him to his move, that's a different subject.
Yeah.
But I think that's really pretty sad.
Now, some of, James Dillon in the book suggested, in fact, that it may well have been Mossad who provided some technical assistance along those lines. But
well, you know, far be it from me. That's I have absolutely no thoughts on the subject. I would only say again, who in hell outside Iran could come back and teach the Persians anything about torture? I mean, they've been doing it for 6,000 years. It's like saying that CIA went in and taught them how to weave an Isfahani rug, or we went in there and taught them how to use opium, or we went in and taught them how to set up a prostitution ring, or we went in and told them how to sell rugs. I think it's ludicrous on the face of it. You wouldn't go to Mexico City and teach a Mexican how to fry beans. I don't think. Anyway, it makes me angry, as you might imagine.
Okay. Don, are there any concluding comments that you'd like to make?
Yes, a couple I really would like to make. The Iranians are in my, you know, relatively limited experience. That's 18 years in various parts of Middle East and South Asia. So that's something, but that certainly doesn't make me an expert. Iranians are a very guileful and intelligent people. They are skillful in human relations. They are skillful at politics in all of its forms. They are in many ways a very admirable people. They are very conscious of their cultural heritage, and kids are still named Sohrab, and Khurush, and Cyrus, and Xerxes, and so on. They are very conscious and very proud of their traditions, and they should be. They have much to be proud of. There have been revivals of religious fundamentalism in Iran, as elsewhere in the Middle East, repeatedly over time. Nothing new under the sun, not that, because everything's new. Every time like this is new and different. But after the mullahs have gone, Iran will tend to go back to where it was, as the Chinese, for example, are going back to patterns they followed before Mao, which may be a bad omen for the Russians, given the nature of their cultural history, as we constantly revert to our own, whatever variations may occur. They're intelligent people, they're thoughtful people, they're artistic people, they're creative people. They managed to throw up some very interesting political leaders, era by era by era, all rooted in Persepolis and Takht-i Jamshid and Rumi and Sa'di and Jungmi and the poetic and religious and cultural traditions that are theirs, very much theirs. No Iranian I know who is not in Iran wishes he were anywhere but in Iran. And when it's possible to go back, as in the Lebanon, for example, I think most of the Iranians who can, everything considered, will go back. There is still a lot of traffic back and forth between, for example, the U.S. and Iran. People going back to see families. People who are in some jeopardy, but because a mother is ill or a father is buried or a cousin is in trouble, are allowed to come and spend time and leave. And the students are still here in great numbers. So I think if we can only get away from our quick fix view of the world and of history and of politics toward Iran, and assuming that it doesn't degenerate into another Lebanon, yes, left to its own devices, which it won't be, of course, it will settle down. It will settle down, meaning it will return to similar form of old patterns. They are very impressive people. They are unusual in the Middle East. They are very creative, and presumably they will find ways to recreate a life which is different from the one they have now. A very obvious indication of their creativity is the fact that the mullahs have been running that country and running it reasonably well, given the war and all, now for 9 years. Not doing a bad job. These are smart people. I think of the two Marines who went off to deal with them, Oliver North and his boss. That's tough. That's a very tough assignment. If they were gulled to this degree or that, they weren't the first and they won't be the last. The mullahs gull each other. If Montazari thinks he's going to run the country, I don't know what he thinks, but if he thinks he's going to run the country, he's just not paying attention. He's not going to run the country. They are a very skillful group at manipulating each other. They have deep, abiding ties one to another, and deep, abiding ties to their own culture, and this will continue long after the mullahs have kind of gone back into their mosques. I wish the Americans understood how long history is and what its ingredients are. Jesus. We're dealing with a culture which is one of the ancient cultures. And Shia Islam and Zoroastrianism are not separate. That's one of the things that makes them different. And they know it. And I wish we knew that. I wish we understood them at that level. Because a lot of things would not be so mysterious and surprising. There wouldn't be nearly so many surprises. But that's true of the Middle East. That is, alas, probably true of our relationship with Mexico. But maybe in the next 20 or 30 years, we will learn that the outside world has a huge impact on us, and that our level of understanding has to be very significantly increased by historians, by oral histories, by travel, by reading, by languages. We've got a lot to learn. And I think some of these problems are manifest, some of these flaws in our own approach are manifested in our policy toward Iran the last 30 years. So much for that.
Thanks very much for your time.
And opinion.
Thanks very much.